International Vice President of the Theosophical Society. All these things are, for him, consuming passions. I asked Professor Aljo, who addressed the Theosophical Society's annual convention earlier this month here in New Zealand, whether there is a link between language and fantasy and theosophy.
I suppose officially there is no link, but I see language as a phenomenon that theosophy helps to make some comments about, helps to explain in certain ways.
In what way?
Well, for one thing, theosophy says, along with a great many other religious traditions, that change is in the nature of reality, that everything is constantly changing. The Buddha said that, Heraclitus in Greece said that, and that's a basic proposition of theosophy, that there is constant change in everything, and language is constantly changing, so that in a period of 1,000 years, English has changed so much that it would be... The old form of English is a foreign language to us. For example, here's a little text. Fader ura thu art en heonum, suthin nama yahalgad, to becometin richa yawurthin willa on erdan, and so on. That's the beginning of the Lord's Prayer, as it would have been said about 1,000 years ago.
In England?
In England, right. Yes, indeed. Anglo-Saxon, as it's sometimes called, or Old English.
Do you think that language is still changing at that rate?
Oh,
or I just wondered whether the fact that it is written down now pegs it somewhat and slows its evolution.
Probably the rate of change varies from time to time, but simply writing it down I don't think has much effect on its change. What does affect the rate of change is the rate of social change which is going on. So that in England at the time of the Norman Conquest, great social changes went on, and that produced great changes in the language. Today, I think, great changes in the language are in the offing, partly because of the great technological changes which are happening in the world, and partly because of the spread of English over the globe.
I know that you were editor of Volume 6 of the Cambridge History of the English Language, I think.
That's right.
Which focused on the history of English in North America.
That's
from
right.
Its British background. And a new language was required in that case. I was interested in one comment you made about how in English they had a description of a riverbank which was a fairly low slung affair, but in America they had huge high bluffs was the word they come up with.
Right.
Which wasn't required in England.
Yes, because, of course, the physical phenomenon didn't exist in Great Britain.
Yeah.
So that any time you have this kind of change of experience of speakers, then their language has to change.
So where did the word bluff come from in the first place?
Well, actually, it was an English word. It was simply the meaning of it which changed. A bluff was, again, a kind of bank or hill, not associated necessarily with a river.
And so Americans...
It was also a naval term that was used for shipsides.
So was there very much use of American Indian words in the evolution of American English?
There are a fair number that have come into English. Most of them are associated, however, with Indian artifacts, moccasin, teepee, that sort of thing.
Right.
Although also names of plants and vegetables, succotash, which is a kind of squash, is an Indian word. But especially the influence is in place names.
Mm.
Just as in New Zealand, you've got a great many place names which are Maori in origin.
Mm.
So in America, an enormous number of place names are American Indian in origin.
Have you spent sufficient time in New Zealand to comment on the New Zealand use of the English language?
I'm not an authority on that subject, so anything I say is simply an offhand reaction to it. New Zealand English is one of the major national varieties of the international language of English. It is, to the untrained American ear, very similar to Australian, although I've been in New Zealand often enough, I've been here twice and long enough to recognize differences between Australian and New Zealand pronunciation.
Mm.
Both New Zealand pronunciation belongs to the general category of British origins. But in fact, there are only two major varieties of the English language in the world, major varieties. One is British-based and the other is American-based. And the British base is, of course, far more widespread because of the British Empire.
Huh. The evolution of accents and dialects is interesting, isn't it? I mean, do you have any observation to make about how the American accent evolved, or indeed the New Zealand or Australian accent?
Well, curiously enough, the American accent is probably closer to the original pronunciation of English in Great Britain before the 16th century than is contemporary British English. For example, Americans pronounce the R in words where it is spelled, by and large.
What are you thinking of?
A father.
Oh,
father.
Okay.
A card instead of card.
Yes.
The R was historically pronounced in English, and it only got lost from British English in the years after the settlement of America.
Why did it become lost?
It's very hard to say why anything happens in language, that kind of change. There is a kind of natural drift in language in which each generation learns the language in a slightly different way from the older generation. And over a period of time, that results in a progressive change. Now, what happens is that if you have two speech communities, two groups of people who are not in close contact with one another, who don't talk with one another all the time, they will change in different directions. And that's what happened with American and British English. That's what happened with New Zealand and British English.
Does it irritate you that American English is seen as lesser or subordinate or wrong?
Well, of course, we don't regard it as lesser or subordinate or wrong.
No, but when you visit the some English-speaking countries of the world, Britain, for example, and indeed New Zealand, you will have heard complaints about the invasion of American English.
Yes, of course. No, but that's perfectly normal. That is to say, human beings all think that the way they do things is the right way, and the way other people do things is the wrong way, insofar as it differs from the way we do things. So that's a perfectly normal kind of human phenomenon. There's no point in being annoyed about it because it's inevitable. Everybody feels that way unless they stop and think and realize how foolish that view is.
So if your attitude is that language is continually evolving and the only constant is change, then is there anything in the use of language that you think should not happen? I mean, you know the whole argument about split infinitives, blah. Are you a grammarian?
Yes, I regard myself as a grammarian, but perhaps not in the sense you mean it. Partly knowing something about the history of the language makes it very difficult to get upset about certain matters.
Yes.
You mentioned the split infinitive. There has never been a time in the entire history of the English language when infinitives were not split. The notion that they should not be was an invention of about the 17th or 18th centuries. And it was by analogy with Latin, where, of course, you cannot split an infinitive because the infinitive marker is on the end of the word.
Right.
But the two which marks the infinitive in English has, from the earliest recorded times, been split from the verb by various modifiers. So that's a perfectly normal kind of thing. People who think that it's wrong simply don't know enough about the history of the English language.
So why are people still insisting on bringing out that old, you must not split the infinitive, it is wrong to split the infinitive?
Because people like to have a clear notion of what is right and wrong. People like to people like to be told, and even better, to be able to tell other people what's right. That, again, is a perfectly normal kind of human response
to
variation.
Is there anything in the use of language, either written or spoken, that, I'm trying to avoid the use of the word irritate here, that you think is unwise?
Yes, of course. I think that anything in language is unwise which impedes communication.
Right.
So that one has to be sensitive to other person's reaction to language.
Right.
And try to avoid those things which are going to irritate other people.
I can see when you said that people like to have a clear notion of right and wrong, I thought that would bring us tidily back to theosophy, of course, because
it seems
to me that theosophy is a way of incorporating as many beliefs as possible in some kind of unified field theory.
I think that's a good way of putting it. A basic proposition of theosophy is that there are many ways of viewing the universe and of life and ultimate values, And these ways are suitable to different times and different peoples and different cultures. So that what we should try to do is to understand other people's views of how the world is.
But of course, that's very upsetting to people who say, no, no, there's no point in understanding all those other people's views because this view is the right one.
Yeah, that again is kind of normal human reaction. But then humans tend to be self-centered. And that's all right. At a certain stage of human development, you expect an infant to be self-centered. Infants are supposed to be self-centered. But when infants become adults, you expect them to have some consideration for those around them. And that consideration necessarily involves respecting the opinions of other people in matters which are not matters of harmfulness or hurtfulness.
Is it possible to be a Christian and a theosophist, or a Muslim and a theosophist?
Oh, good heavens, yes.
Because many Christians would say no.
Yes, I know. Some Christians would. But we have members of the Theosophical Society who are Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, or Anglicans, Roman Catholics nowadays, and Unitarians, of practically every Christian church.
I don't know whether you've come across Lloyd Gearing, who's a New Zealand theologian who's just written a book called Christianity Without Christ. But it is a fact, presumably, that you can't be, according to the common wisdom, Christian if you don't believe Christ is the only true Savior. And I don't think theosophists will claim that Christ is the only true Savior.
Not the only true one, but a savior. I once was speaking at a college which was a fundamentalist college to a group of theological students, and I was asked the inevitable question: do you accept Christ as your personal savior? And my response was, of course I do, along with the Buddha, Zoroaster, Moses, and a great many others. I think that wise people have been born into the world at various times to bring important messages to humanity. And all of those, in a sense, are our saviors. Because if we pay attention to their messages, the world will be a better place than it otherwise would be.
The book I mentioned was not called Christianity Without Christ, Christianity Without God. Where's God in theosophy?
Well, again, God is a concept that people tend to build up various kinds of metaphors and mythic images around. Theosophy believes that there is a ultimate intelligent power in the universe, and we can call that power God. Incidentally, the Theosophical Society is completely non-dogmatic. So when I say theosophy believes, what I'm really saying is my understanding of theosophy is this.
Right.
It's entirely personal.
It's a club that anyone can belong to.
Yep. Well, provided you meet the basic rules.
What are the basic rules?
All right. The basic rules are an acceptance of the three objects of the society. And the first object is to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. And the second object is to encourage the study of comparative religion, philosophy, and science. And the third object is to investigate unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent in humanity.
So you can see why people regard it as somewhat New Age, I suppose.
Yeah, except that we're too old to be New Age.
Yeah. Is it an alternative name for theosophy? Is the wisdom tradition, is it?
That's right. It's sometimes called the wisdom tradition. It's sometimes called the ancient wisdom, sometimes the timeless wisdom.
Right. So how long do you reckon that the theosophy has been around for?
Okay, well, the society was founded in 1875.
That's right.
But
Madame Blavatsky, wasn't it?
Well, she was one of the chief founders, a Russian noblewoman who was resident in America.
She's had somewhat of a checkered press, it's be fair to say.
Well, let's say she had a checkered reputation.
Yeah. I mean, she's generally regarded as not being in full possession of her marbles.
Oh, no, I don't think that's true.
She had all the marbles.
Oh, I think so, absolutely. Okay. She was a woman, she was a Russian woman given to sometimes rather violent displays of emotion. But I think that was her Russianness rather than anything else.
Okay.
No, she was a very bright woman. Her writings display a knowledge of just world philosophies and religions and mythologies that are really quite staggering.
What made her found it in 1875?
Pardon?
What made her found Theosophy in 1975 in an official fashion, I mean?
1875.
What did I say? 1918. What provoked her to do that, given that, you know, we're talking about ancient wisdom here?
Yeah, she had a sense of mission. That is, that the world needs to have understanding of the way things are. And the way things are includes the fact that all human beings are essentially the same. As modern biologists have shown, we are genetically almost identical with one another. The differences between us are extremely small.
We're also genetically almost identical to chimpanzees.
Yes, chimpanzees are our closest species. And most theosophists believe that a respect for life should extend not only to other human beings, but to all other living creatures.
Right.
So that it is not a requirement for membership in the society, but a great many theosophists are vegetarians.
Are you?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, you say very definitely.
You're right.
I mean... You became a theosophist, I think, or you joined the Theosophical Society at the age of 16.
Yes, that's right.
Which sounds an early age to be interested in such deep issues.
Yes, well, I came across a theosophical book and read it and was so impressed by what seemed to me to be a unified vision of the world and the purpose of the world and the meaning of life that I was led to join the society.
I mean, how did people view you in Miami at the time?
My mother said, I hope you know what you're getting into.
What did she think you were getting into? Was she Roman Catholic?
Yes, my family were Roman Catholics. Mm. Uh-huh. Well, she didn't know, but I had a very tolerant family.
And so from that point on, you became what, a vegetarian?
I became a vegetarian very early, yes.
Yeah. And you eschewed Roman Catholicism, or you would still consider yourself to be Roman Catholic?
Well, actually, in those days, you could not be Roman Catholic and a theosophist.
Right.
It was only later after...
You mean what happened?
After
you were
Vatican.
The Vatican
Council.
Ruled.
Right.
Okay.
After the Vatican Council, Roman Catholic rules were relaxed so that one could be both.
Yeah.
So I became an Anglican at that time.
Because you could be an Anglican and a theosophist.
Exactly, that's right.
Why did you need to be something and a theosophist?
Well, because theosophy is not a religion. It's a vision of life. But the theosophical motto is, we don't ask you to leave your religion, we ask you to live it.
But you didn't. You didn't not leave your religion, you took up a whole new one. Or a different variety of the same.
Actually, Anglicans and Roman Catholics are not that far apart in many ways.
But you felt the need for a religion as well as theosophy.
Yeah, of course. Yes.
And still do?
Yes, uh-huh.
So what does Anglicanism, if indeed you're still an Anglican, what does that offer you that theosophy doesn't?
A religion provides a kind of social structure within a community.
I was going to suggest that Anglicanism might be a social club and theosophy is what you think about at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, that perhaps is not too far off.
Really?
Probably not too far off. But that's not to say that it's a social club is not dismissive.
No,
I think.
Heavens,
social relations are absolutely important, and theosophy would regard them as important. When people don't talk together, just as we said earlier, their languages drift apart and eventually become different languages. And when people don't talk together, their lives drift apart. And they become perhaps sometimes violent enemies. So the first thing to do to bring about world peace is to get people to understand one another, to talk with one another, and to understand one another.
We don't seem to be doing too well on that front.
Not just now, but that's partly because we are not talking together enough. I think that the current world crisis is largely one which is due to differences of values and worldviews. Obviously, there are economic and social problems, but basically...
The differences in values and worldviews are visceral. They're not superficial.
That's right. How does one change something which is visceral? Well, to begin with, I think one has to come into an understanding of other people's viscerality. And the process of learning about other people broadens one's own view and makes one more tolerant of differences and leads one to assess one's own views as perhaps not the only valid ones in the universe. The great English poet John Milton, who was himself a Puritan, wrote to one of his less open Puritan friends as follows. He said, "I beseech you in the bowels of Christ, consider that you may be wrong." And I think all of us have to consider that we may be wrong.
Mm. I wondered where reincarnation fitted in to your, you know, conversations with yourself at 2 o'clock in the morning, because I know that that's one of the tenets. Can I call it that? One of the tenets of theosophy.
Sure, as long as we understand the tenets are not dogmas.
They're not proscriptible, prescriptive. That's right.
Exactly. Some theosophers would be vegetarians, some not. Some theosophers believe in reincarnation, some not.
Okay.
This is not a matter of definition of what it means to be a theosophist.
But I take it you do believe in reincarnation.
Yes, I do.
You've written a book about it.
Yeah, that's right. So I have.
Reincarnation Explored, in which you clearly think that there are things which are only explicable by reincarnation.
Well, perhaps not only explicable, but there are things in life which I think are best explained by reincarnation. And indeed, that view of things is rather substantiated by the work of an American psychologist by the name of Ian Stevenson, who has devoted his life to studying cases of reported memories of past lives, particularly among young children. And he has published a great many case studies on that.
Yeah.
And I think they're very convincing.
We have phenomena such as xenoglossy, people breaking out into a language which they have no knowledge of at all.
Yeah, that can sometimes be explained in other ways. Well, Stevenson is not one who's easily deceived. He looks at all possible explanations of everything, such as xenoglossy.
Mm-hmm. And has concluded that.
And has concluded that, on the whole, there are certain cases where reincarnation is, in fact, the best explanation of the observed facts.
Why should we be reincarnated?
Well, again, a theosophical view is that we are in the world to learn. And one lifetime is not long enough to learn everything there is to learn about
We all know that.
We all know that.
But the thing that baffles me is that how come you don't remember what you've already learned?
Well, how do you know you don't remember? That is to say, what we learn, we're not talking about facts. Though those are trivial matters. What we need to learn is how to relate to other people. We need to learn spiritual values and moral values.
Right.
And people do come into the world with different inclinations towards all sorts of things, including moral and spiritual values. So that in a sense, we do remember past lives.
Okay.
We don't remember facts about them.
Yeah.
But we remember, we have dispositions to respond in certain ways.
So the world should be getting a better and better place as we become wiser and wiser.
In the long run, it should be indeed.
And do you think that it is?
It's very hard to tell.
Like, too soon after the French Revolution to say whether it was a success or not.
Well, the thing is, we can't judge in terms of short periods of time. And when we're talking about the history of the world, we're talking about exceedingly long periods of time. Furthermore, today, one might get the impression the world's the worst place than it's ever been. But the fact is, what we have is better reporting than we've ever had before.
Yeah.
So it may be that the ills which we read about and hear about through news media are in fact really the result of more thorough reporting than we've ever had before.
I can see that it would be a very good thing if as many people as possible believed in reincarnation, because it would be a check on stuffing it up too badly or treating other people too badly. Karma would get you in the end.
Hmm.
Do you think that something, I'm not meaning to attack any belief you may have in reincarnation, but I'm merely suggesting that something being a good thing to believe in may be an end in itself.
Yes, frankly, I do. I'm from an American background where
wishful thinking is good enough.
No, not wishful thinking, but thinking which has results, which has positive results, pragmatism. Pragmatism is a philosophical approach very much associated with certain American philosophers, such as William James and John Dewey. And pragmatism holds that if something produces the results you want, then it's a good thing.
In your book on reincarnation, Reincarnation Explored, it's called, you say, and it just go back to what you were saying about the individual, one aim of reincarnation is to develop the individual self as completely as possible, to build it up and release its potential through a vast series of personal lives or incarnations. Reincarnation is the means by which we make ourselves, by which we become fully individual. Now, one could argue that one of the problems in the world today is that we have become too focused on the individual and not sufficiently focused on society or the world at large. And I'm wondering whether that could be a problem in the kind of belief structure that theosophy suggests.
I don't think so, because remember, the first object of the Theosophical Society is to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity. To be developed personally is not enough to be developed in isolation. We, in fact, develop personally by forgetting our persons and by working instead for the welfare of others. People have come to me in the past with all sorts of personal problems, wanting to know what they should do about them. And my standard advice to them is, forget about yourself. Go out and get involved in community service. Do something for the good of other people. Focus on others and not on yourself, and then yourself will improve.
Which, it seems to me, is a big differentiation between theosophy and so-called New Age beliefs.
Yes, I think that's true. New Age tends to be far more personally oriented.
Right.
Madame Blavatsky, who was one of the chief founders of the society, once said that theosophy is altruism. That is to say, a concern for the welfare of others.
Hmm. Do you think that it has more aspects of Eastern religions than Western theosophy?
It's difficult to say. In the West, the answer is yes. In the East, the answer is no. One of the aims of theosophy is to serve as a bridge between different systems of thought, and particularly between Eastern and Western thought. So in the West, it appears to be more Eastern. But in the East, in India, it's often thought of as being Western.
I tell you, one of the main problems I have with the reincarnation concept is, and you've dealt with this a million times, no doubt, there are more people in the world now than there used to be. So what have we got? A whole influx of new souls. Now, I know that one of your answers to that, as in your book, is that we're not quite sure what the population of the world used to be. So how can we say that it's greater now or that much greater now? But surely that's a bit weak. That's a weak argument.
Yeah, I agree. That's a weak argument. I'm just
pointing out. That's the only one you got.
Give me another one. Oh, no, it's not. For one thing, we don't know necessarily how frequently reincarnation occurs. That is to say, in some cultures that believe in reincarnation, they think it happens immediately. That's not the theosophical view. The theosophical view is that between the death of the body and the rebirth of the consciousness in a new body, there lapses quite a long period of time, typically. That period of time may be 1,000 or 1,500 years.
Sort of a little vacation from the world.
Oh, yeah, that's a kind of recovery. It may be that that period of space between incarnations varies for reasons we may not know over time. So perhaps at the present time, and indeed recently, the period between incarnations has reduced in length, and that would produce a larger population.
And
there are other possibilities.
Such as?
Oh, well, such as perhaps new souls are coming in from someplace outside the earth. Perhaps this is not a closed system. Perhaps it's an open system. There are very likely to be intelligent beings in other worlds. So perhaps we're just getting new souls coming in.
And do you think that the current popularity, this is back to another of your interests, of course, the current popularity of Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter is part of people's quest for something else?
Yes, I think it certainly is. Human beings need a mythology to live by. A mythology is a story which is not necessarily accepted as literally true, but which embodies the values which they hold dearest and believe will best govern their lives and give them the most satisfactory existence, not only personally, but humanity as a whole. Every people need, every person and every people need a mythology. Now, the mythology which has dominated European life, and that, of course, includes New Zealand and America, since we are culturally European, the mythology which dominated European life has become severely weakened in our time. And so what we are getting is new mythologies from J.R. Tolkien, from J.K. Rowling, from various other writers and creators.
Right. So Harry Potter's the new King Arthur.
Indeed, I think very much so.
Professor John Aljo, he's Emeritus Professor of English at the University of Georgia, and he's also the International Vice President of the Theosophical Society. He was over here for the New Zealand Theosophical Society's annual convention earlier this month. And yes, I know, as soon as I said it, that Lloyd Gearing's book, Christianity Without God, is not Christianity Without Christ, and corrected myself shortly thereafter, but not soon enough for some of you who, quickly and on the ball as you are, rang the newsroom to inform them, and the newsroom informed us, because we have systems that work around here. Coming up,